Yes, this is geologist Jim Berkland, and I'm an earthquake expert. I didn't expect to be, but when I became the county geologist for Santa Clara County in 1973, I was informed that from all my 10 years of college and university that no one could predict earthquakes because they were random events. There was a few scatterings in the literature and on the radio about people claiming they were predicting quakes, but 99.9% of the time they were wrong. So I went along with the popular belief because as a mainstream geologist, I didn't believe in rocking boats. And I rose to become the first county geologist in Northern California. And I was most pleased. I'd attended Berkeley and for my bachelor's degree in San Jose State for my master's. And then I worked for 10 years with the federal government, half between the U.S. Geological Survey and half with the Bureau of Reclamation, where I became an engineering geologist. Still retain my registration number 58 in the state of California. And then I went back to school at the time of the geologic revolution, which culminated in 1969 when there was a major meeting at Pacific Grove near Monterey, and experts from around the world, oceanographers and astronomers and geologists and geophysicists and seismologists and paleontologists all got together and began to compare notes from what they were finding in various places around the world, especially with the recent discoveries from space and from oceanographic studies of the group they call JOIDES. And they began to put together quite a puzzle that we weren't just a lot of separate pieces of the puzzle around the world, but at one time they matched. When the continents were all together on a couple of occasions, and then split apart. And finally, they began to put together why the volcanoes were where they were, and why the deep trenches were where they were. And there's the big oceanic ridges with volcanic islands on them. And it all finally began to make sense at this great meeting in the fall of 1969. That happened to be the year that I went back to school. And I worked 3 years on my doctorate at University of California, Davis. And I had an excellent field area near Clear Lake and found some fantastic fossil collections and put together a number of stories about how the rocks got to where they were. In fact, I gave a talk at the International Congress of Geologists in 1973 in Montreal, Canada. And the former head of the U.S. Geological Survey heard my talk, and afterwards, Jim Galluli said, "You know, Jim, that was a good talk, a damn good talk. You know, you could be right." And I understand from this guy that that was a very high compliment. So I went on then to teach a year at Appalachian State University in North Carolina. And while I was down there one night grading papers, I suddenly went through my old science news week that comes out weekly, and I saw this article titled that a seamount in California discovered. It was helped to prove that plate tectonics was real, and I thought, who's stolen my idea? Well, it turns out they were reviewing my paper from Montreal, so that was very gratifying for me. Anyway, I passed an oral exam to become the first county geologist in Northern California for Santa Clara County, and came out, left my job as an assistant professor at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina, and came back to where I was born in the state of California. and took the reins and found my niche. What a great role to become a geologist, to have your ideas paid attention to and not shuffled off, as often happens with assistant geologists. I was the main man for Santa Clara County, and I got to work as a liaison person with city and county geologists and state geologists and private individuals, and go and speak to schools and various civic groups, and pass along the word and help to educate people on the importance of understanding what's going out in the world and relating to natural hazards. And you just can't ignore them because they're almost everywhere. You cannot escape them no matter where you go. And, of course, California is always famous for having a lot of earthquakes. In fact, when the students heard I was coming back to California in North Carolina, "You're going back to California with all those earthquakes?" And I said, "I sure am, and I'm leaving the hurricanes and the tornadoes and the blizzards and the frost and all these things." And if you go to the Southwest, you worry about dust storms and drought and cloudbursts and that sort of thing. So every place has their problems, and it's just a matter of dealing with them. So when I became the county geologist, I was greeted between September and December of 1973 by six earthquakes from 3.2 to 4.8, and two of them I felt myself. The others, what people told me about it or heard about it on my daily contacts with the U.S. Geological Survey and the what was then called the Division of Mines and Geology for California. It's now called the California Geologic Survey. But I would note these earthquakes and people that had felt them and what damage may have occurred, and no possibility of predicting them. I had no idea of doing that. And then on the 8th of January in 1974, after being on duty for about 4 months, I saw an article in the paper that was nationwide, published from various media, and the source was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they talked about the possibility of coastal flooding along seacoasts because there was an unusual astronomical alignment. Well, I checked on the almanacs, and I've been kind of an almanac buff since I was a kid, and I found that on that very day, January 8, 1974, it was the first full moon of the year, and it was only an hour and a half away from the closest approach of the moon in several years. The closest approach of the moon for the year, and this is called a perigee, every month the closest approach is a perigee, and the moon can get down to about 221,000 miles away from the Earth. And then in July, or that in just maybe 2 weeks later, it's at a far point. And that's called apogee, and that can be 253,000 and even more miles away. So the moon varies about 14% of its distance in just 2 weeks' time. So it's really whipping around the Earth rapidly every 29 and a half days and changing its distance. So when the moon is closed, its gravitational effect is stronger than when it's far. That's quite logical. And also, when the moon and sun and Earth are lined up, the Earth is like in a tug of war, and it causes the ocean levels to rise. And so the highest highs of the tides and the lowest lows of the tides are usually on the same day. And they're usually within 2 days of the new or full moon when the sun, moon, and Earth are lined up at a time called syzygy. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. It's from the Greek zygos, meaning yoked together like a team of oxen. And so when this occurs, just every 2 weeks, we have the maximum tides. And it occurred to me that since the ocean waters are being pulled up by this gravitational tug of war, perhaps the solid Earth was also moving up and down. And could that possibly trigger fault lines into action? So I looked at the timing of the six quakes from September to December of 73, and by golly, they all fit this pattern. Right after the full moon, right after the perigee, or right close to the perihelion when the sun, moon, and Earth are closest in early January. So in January of 1974, we did have all of those things happening almost the same time. The closest approach of the sun on January 3rd for the whole year, and the closest approach of the moon in about 5 years, and that was only an hour and a half away from the lining up of the sun, moon, and Earth, so we had it all. And so, indeed, the tides were extremely high, but it can bring you to the point of flooding just from the astronomy. But in order to have real flooding, then you need maybe onshore winds or freshwater flooding in the rivers meeting the high tides coming in from the sea, or perhaps a low pressure cell moving overhead. That allows also the water to rise higher than normal. Well, it turns out in the Bay Area, it was a bluebird day on January 8, 1974, and the flooding came right to the tops of the levees near Alviso in the southern part of San Francisco Bay, but we had no flooding here. However, down at Oxnard on Southern California, there were strong winds coming from the sea, and that combined with the high tides did cause a lot of coastal damage and some flooding. But no flooding here. But anyway, because of the concern about this unusual astronomical alignment, and my discovery that the six previous quakes all fit the pattern, I made my first prediction to people in the office who kind of thought that geologists were a little strange anyway, but perhaps we all were predicting quakes. And I said, based on this unusual gravitational stress, I expect a 4.5 point magnitude quake to occur within a week in Santa Clara County. And they kind of shrugged it off. And then I was talking to a geologist with the Division of Mines and Geology about future contracts where they could come down and share the costs, and we would investigate the basic geology of our county and have cooperative studies, which had been done on occasion, and it did indeed come to pass and was very useful. But I can mention to the geologist with the state, by the way, we have this really high tide, and I think we may well have a quake of 4 to 5 magnitude in a week. And he said, oh, is that right? And he very quickly changed the subject, because geologists don't want to be considered as charlatans or astrologers or whatever. And all I knew is that I had an idea, and I checked into the data, and it matched the concept, and so I felt justified at least throwing out the possibility we're going to have a quake within a week of 4 to 5 magnitude, and 2 days later it hit. 4.3 quake about 15 miles south of San Jose and generally felt around the county. So I was really encouraged by that and say, hey, this wild idea means something. So I made another prediction in February, and that one hit. So it was much smaller. It was only about a 3.4. But through the year 1974, I ended up making 8 predictions. 6 of them were right. Well, that's 75%, 6 out of 8. And I've continued to maintain that average ever since 1974. So this is 32 years now, and my average is still 3 out of 4. And chance would allow me 1 out of 4. And that's because I have what's called an 8-day seismic window, a term I invented in January 1974. And at that point, there was only one window of time that I was aware of, and that was from NASA. There were 3 or 4 days per month when a moonshot could be effective. Otherwise, the moon would be fleeing the Earth in its orbit again, and the rocket would have to try to catch the moon, whereas much better just to intercept it in its path. But you only had, 2 or 3 or 4 days per month where that could be effective. And so they called it a time window where you could make an effective moonshot. Well, in the same way, I visualized earthquake vulnerability times as a seismic window. And it also had a relatively short time, and it expanded from the week to 8 days when I found that many of the quakes occurred just beyond or just ahead of the newer full moon. So the most striking quake that I hit in 1974 was the first 5 magnitude quake in 3 years in the Bay Area. And we had a 5.2 quake called the Thanksgiving Day quake, just south of Gilroy in Santa Clara County. And I had predicted that we would have such a quake at a meeting of the U.S. Geological Survey's Pick and Hammer Club. Now, as a former member of the USGS, this informal group of experts in various fields in natural science, called the Pick and Hammer Club, and they had monthly meetings and had guest speakers, and some very wild ideas would come out, and some of them turned out to be worth important papers. But, of course, you can get all the geologists together with a little beer drinking, and they would be kibitzing quite a bit. And some of the ideas never bore fruit, but it was always valuable, a good give and take, and we always enjoyed these meetings. So I went to the library the day before Thanksgiving at the U.S. Geological Survey, where I was often getting books and publications and talking to people. And I saw on the bulletin board that they were having a meeting that night of the Pick and Hammer Club, and it was going to be discussing the state of the art of earthquake prediction. And they had one geologist or seismologist that was looking at magnetic field changes, and one was looking at the tilt of the ground, and another one was looking at patterns of small quakes south of Hollister along the San Andreas Fault. And so I mentioned to my former master's thesis advisor from San Jose State University, Dr. Robert Rose, who was the head of the department at that time, that they were having this interesting meeting, and if he wanted to drive up with me to the meeting, I'd be happy to meet him and you know, join me in a little mini carpool. So we did just that, and I regaled him with my idea on the way up there, and had prepared a little table showing when the past quakes had occurred in late 1973 and up until November of 1974, and showed how most of them fit this idea I had. And I asked the moderator of the meeting that night if I could speak when the three scheduled speakers were done. And Bob Christensen said, "Sure, Jim." Well, it turned out the regularly scheduled speakers were still going the meeting was supposed to be over at 10 o'clock, and they were still going strong at 10:45, so the moderator came over and said, "Jim, we'll catch you next month." I said, "Just give me 5 minutes. This is really hot, and I'm sorry." So I ended up not being able to speak. That would have been quite a breakthrough if I'd been able to address the group briefly that night. But as it was, I handed out 10 copies of my table of earthquakes and my prediction that we would have a 3.5 to 5.5 magnitude quake in the South Bay within a week. And so the next day was Thanksgiving Day. And my young daughter, who at the time was 6 years old, we decided that we'd go see the movies and let my wife work slave over the turkey and get out of her hair, you know. And so we did go over to the movie in Santa Clara. And while we're at the movie, the earthquake hit. Now, ironically, and this is absolutely true, we thought it was part of the special effects of the first run of the movie Earthquake, which was playing at the theater when it hit. And, of course, the censure round and all these noises and special effects were excellent, but it wasn't until it came out 15 minutes after the quake, the movie was over, and I turned on the car radio and heard about this 5.2 quake that was felt from Monterey to Modesto to Santa Rosa, Salinas, and all around the Bay Area. And for a few seconds, I was nonplussed and thought, what is this? Orson Welles, the invasion of the extraterrestrials or something. But no, it was a real quake. And not just the one that the cinematically destroyed Los Angeles. And then I was most pleased, except, and I looked at my watch, I said, "Hey, the quake happened at 3:01 in the afternoon, and my seismic window did not open until 9 hours later at midnight." So I was 9 hours off for the strongest quake to hit the Bay Area in about 3 years. And so the critics always have told me that was a total miss. Well, I think that you need to be a little more flexible when dealing with Mother Nature, because she doesn't like to be pinned down that much. And certainly, if you're within a few minutes, that should count. But I've been told if I was 1 minute off, it happened 1 minute before midnight, that would be a wrong prediction, even though such a quake hadn't happened for years. Well, that's ridiculous. And also, if I said it was going to be a 5 magnitude quake and it came in at 4.8 or 4.9, that was also a total miss, and the whole prediction could be discounted. That's also ridiculous, because you keep finding that different seismographic stations read the magnitudes differently, and they're pretty much trying to discard now the Richter scale. And so easily you see variations of several tenths of a magnitude and maybe up to a half a magnitude. And so if one station says it was a 4.8 and the other one said it was a 5.1, who was right? And if you predicted a 5 magnitude minimum, wasn't that correct? At least to one of the stations. So this is another one of the running battles I've been having with my colleagues, who feel that no earthquake prediction is valid unless it's exactly right. Well, they must be used to mathematical formulas or working with chemicals where you can predict the results, you know, rather precisely. Titration of acids and bases, and know exactly what the pH is. That's not the way earthquakes work. And if you predict a 5 magnitude quake for a particular area that hasn't had one for several years, that's a pretty good prediction if you're within a day or so. So actually, I've, in the last few years now, come up with a little rating system, just like a dartboard or a artillery field. If you have soldiers out on the rifle range and they cut loose a volley of shots, they're not going to hit the bullseye every time. But if you're in the next ring out, that counts for something. If you're two rings out, that counts for something. So what I've done is that if I'm within one-tenth of a magnitude of the rating from a leading seismographic station, that would give me 90%. And I'm within one day, that would give me 90%. And if I'm within 10% of the radius of the seismic circle that I set up, that would also be 90%. And in each of those cases, I'd go down one ring out to the third ring. If I'm within 3/10 of magnitude, 70%, 3 days, 70%, and 30% of the radius, 70%. And beyond that, I say I'm off the dartboard and don't count anything. And if I'm 1/10 off of magnitude, that'd be 90%. If I'm one day off, that'd be 90%. And if it's exactly in the area, then I would multiply 0.9 times 0.9 times 1.0, and that would be 81%, because I was at 90% on two of them. You multiply the misses. If any one of them was beyond the third ring, then that would count for nothing. So I've been doing that now for about 4 or 5 years, and encourage anybody else. The people that say you have to be exactly right are the people that want to say that earthquakes cannot be predicted and will never be predicted. And if you discount all of those that are close, then you're going to get close to right, because nobody is going to be exactly right all the time. There will be no magic bullet. And so I've been telling people, since there will be no magic bullet, and I accept that, then you have to use the whole arsenal. And you have to use such things not only as tides, but also animal reactions, a radon gas release, tilt of the ground, magnetic field changes, storms. Heavy rains often lead within a few months to particularly heavy, stronger earthquakes. And there are strain gauges along the faults and patterns of small earthquakes, seismic gaps and time gaps. There are about 15 things that have been used around the world by different people to help predict earthquakes. None of them has been perfect, but if you combine a number of them, then you get a better handle on what's going on. And for example, in 1989, I'd been at this for 15 years, and I saw at the beginning of the year that come October 14th, we were going to have the highest tidal force in 3 years. And back in December of 86, indeed, we had a 9.2-foot tide range at the Golden Gate, and the normal range is about 4 to 5 feet. So this is twice normal. And on that day, we had a 4.6 quake in San Jose, which was widely felt, and which I'd predicted to the Peninsula Geological Society 2 weeks before it happened. I gave them the appropriate window, and on the very first day of the window, the quake happened. The president of the Pacific the Geological Society, PGS, had said that he felt that quake and he would never doubt me again. And I thought he was really risking his career of 35 years with USGS until I later found that he had just retired 2 days after the quake hit, not because of the quake, but it was long scheduled. And when he wrote me a nice little card of congratulations, he was already a retired geologist and didn't have to worry what his former bosses might have thought of the U.S. Geological Survey. Same sort of thing happened with the World Series quake when I predicted it widely and specifically to the Gilroy Dispatch just on Friday the 13th of October. I said it was going to be a 6.5 to 7 between the 14th and 21st of October, and I was 85% confident it would occur. That's the highest confidence level I've ever had. But we had, I knew those extremely high tides were coming up, but we also had whales beaching themselves in San Francisco, extremely rare, baby-beaked whales, 9 feet long. It never happened before. They took them over to Marine World and tried to keep them alive, and they tried to give them fish mash. Instead, they tried to nurse on their fingers, and they realized these were younger than they thought because they almost knew nothing about beaked whales that spend their whole lives out in the deep sea. And then, about a week later, an equally rare pygmy sperm whale washed up at Santa Cruz Beach, about 10 miles from the epicenter, just a few days later. They took him down to Marine Aquarium to raise, try to, you know, keep him alive because they had no more room over the marine world. Also, homing pigeons were getting lost. The most valuable homing pigeons in the Bay Area, a super racer named Roving Girl, the day before the quake, the owner, Nick Carini, of Morgan Hill was out feeding his pigeons, and she flew the coop right over his shoulder, and she disappeared and didn't come back for a week. And he said, when I called him on the phone later, did she come back? Oh, just came back today, and she's dirty, tired, lost weight, looks like she's flown 1,000 miles. She wanted to get the heck out of here because she was detecting changes in the magnetic field that were bothering her. This is how homing pigeons home in. It's quite clear. I used to raise homing pigeons here in Sonoma Valley when I was a teenager, and I had about 30-40 pigeons. And one time I put a couple of them in my knapsack and hiked up to the top of the nearby mountain where I could see my home 3 miles away. And I was a couple thousand feet up, and I told my sister that I was going to release them at 2 o'clock and see what time they got in. Well, I took them out of the knapsack, threw them in the air, and instead of flying straight home, what do these pigeons do? Well, anybody that's been observing pigeons when they release them at a big ballpark, in mass, you know, at a peace demonstration or something, they circle, and they circle, and they circle 4 or 5 or 6 times in mass. And then each of the pigeons takes off in any particular direction, wherever their loft is. How do they do this? Well, it was always a bit of a mystery, and the papers written about how they... And baby pigeons sit in the nest, they look up and study where the stars are. Well, this is nonsense. How do they do it when it's foggy and when it's daytime? However, behind pigeons' eyeballs, they found the mineral magnetite about 1970. And it's quite clear that when you have a magnetic material, if you move it around in a magnetic field, such as surrounds the Earth, you generate a little electrical impulse. So these pigeons actually create a mini generator. They know where north is by the little pea brain picking up the magnetic signals, electric signals, and they fly in the direction of their loft, unless there's been a big solar flare. And then pigeon fanciers long have been paying close attention to what the sun's doing because they realize they have a smash race on their hand if they don't pay attention. Smash races where very few pigeons get back, and sometimes they may only get 10% of their birds back. This happened in 3 races in Pennsylvania about 10 years ago, and within a few days they had the strongest quake in the history of Pennsylvania over near Sharon on the west side of Pennsylvania. But even more meaningful to me, when Nick Carini, who had been a member of their local pigeon fanciers for over 30 years, he said, you know, we had the worst pigeon race, the greatest smash race in the history in the Bay Area, back years ago, and if you're really interested, I'll go back through all the files. Well, he had book after book showing the ancestry of the pigeons and the temperature and the wind velocity and the humidity and everything during the pigeon race. And so he went back through his records, and about a week later he said, Jim, if you're still interested, I got that date. And I said, well, I sure am interested. What was it? He said, we only got 10% of our birds back on the race of March 24th, 1964. Well, I got a shudder up and down my spine, because that was just 3 days before the strongest quake ever measured in North America. This was the Alaskan quake of March 27th, 1964. And you know, that was also on the day of the full moon, the day of syzygy, and it produced a big tsunami that came sweeping down, killed people in Hawaii and Hilo, and killed 11 people in California, Crescent City. A 21-foot tsunami came up in the harbor. Day of the full moon. Well, guess what? That quake, they now call a 9.2 magnitude on the MW scale, which is a moment magnitude. I'm trying to replace Richter scale with a moment magnitude. Well, the next 9 magnitude quake and the big tsunami that occurred was on December 26th, 2 years ago, 2004, Boxing Day, the big one in the Indian Ocean near Sumatra. And you know, it had about an 80-foot tsunami that swept around the islands and all the seashores around the Indian Ocean. And you may know the animals, the big animals like the tigers and the elephants, went fleeing before the tsunami got to them. And they were aware that something had happened that was unpleasant. They were making their escape. They went to high ground. So in advance of the arrival of the tsunami. Guess what day that was? That was December 26th of 2004, the day of the full moon. And then the strongest aftershock, a little further south there in Sumatra, was an 8.7. And it occurred just 3 months later on March the 28th, I believe. And that was also just 3 days after the March full moon. So in that window, pretty hard to avoid seeing a correlation if you keep your eyes and mind open. But if you say earthquakes can't be predicted and things that happen from the sun and moon have nothing to do with the earth, well, that is a rather narrow viewpoint, and you must reject what's going on. And I've noticed that, you know, with the word geo, we have geophysics and geologist and geometry and geography. What is geo? It is the Latin word for earth, geo. And ology is study. And so, isn't it interesting that geo is a perfect anagram for ego? So that does seem to enter in this whole earthquake prediction field, and that's most unfortunate. People are really get very upset. And my former colleagues refused to be on the same radio or television station with me, turns out, most of them, because they think that I'm involved in alchemy or something, certainly in heresy, because I don't go along with the concept you can't predict earthquakes. I know you can. And not only I, but many other people are successfully doing it. And by pooling our resources and our ideas, then we can, I think, eventually come up with what meteorologists do. Now look, when a meteorologist looks out and sees a low pressure cell developing out in the Atlantic somewhere between like June and November, he watches it closely because it may develop into a, you know, more than a depression. It may pretty soon become a gale wind. And if it gets more than 70 miles an hour and starts to rotate with his eye in the middle, you have a full-fledged hurricane. And so he is perfectly justified to say, based on past performance, this hurricane may hit Florida or the East Coast or the Gulf Coast, whatever, and He could be wrong. Well, you're not wrong if you say it could happen. But if you say positively it's going to happen, that's stretching beyond the data. So I never do that myself. I'm usually from 70 and rarely 85% confident in my windows because that's what I, you know, the record that I've been hitting. And so meteorologists also seem to hit about 75%. They seem to be happy with that record. But they fully understand that a big developing low pressure cell may dissipate at sea. And we had a huge hurricane that developed in the Gulf of Mexico about 10 years ago. It filled the whole Gulf, but it sat there and slowly dissipated and never even arrived on shore, though they had, you know, some pretty strong winds, but the hurricane didn't develop. So it may change its course. And so they are difficult to pin down. And so the people have a right to know what's happening. And they can make their own decision if they should board up their windows and evacuate. Or maybe they could just hunker down and ride it through. With earthquakes in the United States, certainly we do not expect people to evacuate. We are not building our houses out of rubble, rock houses without concrete. And we generally use lightweight wood frame buildings, which are pretty common in the United States, but around the world, the forests are being destroyed, and wood is getting harder and harder to come by. Just look at what happened in Greece and much of Italy and the Holy Land and all, where they harvested the wood and made their ships and whatever they needed in those days, firewood. A lot of forests have not returned. But that's why they must build their homes out of other materials. And sometimes they're very, very dense and unflexible and unforgiving when an earthquake hits, a big one. So in the United States, in Japan, another very enlightened country, 5 and even 6 magnitude quakes are often pretty much harmless. Back in 1984, we had a 6.2 quake 3 miles from our house in San Jose, in East San Jose in the foothills. It was over on the Calaveras Fault. We had absolutely no damage. We did have about a foot of water sweep out of our swimming pool and end up down in our neighbor's backyard. But it was, no big deal. We have the house was close to bedrock, built on bedrock. People built on alluvium or right next to a fault or on landslides, then they may suffer severe damage. And if a chimney comes down on them or a big statue or a chandelier or something, that's a real hazard and something that should be thought of in advance. What about that 6.2 quake? It was April 24th of 1984. It was no surprise. It shouldn't have been to anybody. I've been telling several groups, in late 1983, I knew we had the wettest year in the history of San Jose. It beat the former record of 30.05 inches in the year of 1889. Well, guess what? On April 24th of 1890, we had a 6.5 quake in the south of Santa Clara County. So when I saw the new record being topped, I said, folks, we're due for another 6-plus magnitude quake. Well, the experts said, come on, we haven't had one in the Bay Area since 1911, July 1st, when we had a 6.6. Well, that was right after the wettest single month in the history of San Jose. It had 12.5 inches in January of 1911. And there were rowing boats down Santa Clara Street in San Jose. I don't think they've done that since. But March of 1911 was the third wettest March at that time. So then on July 1st, 5 days after the new moon and 5 days after perigee, we got the 6.6 quake. So that was, again, in a clear seismic window following record rainfall. So in 1983, we topped the 1889 record rainfall. And to anyone that would listen, I'd say we're due for another 6, even though we haven't had one since 1911. And I said that to the the group of retired people at CSRS at their meeting in the Evergreen Valley in early 1984. And I also said the same thing to the Milpitas City Council and to the Campbell Chamber of Commerce and to a talk I gave to Seek Technologies in Milpitas. And to all of them, I said we're due for a 6-plus magnitude quake in Santa Clara County this year, 84. Well, can you pin it down better than that? I said, well, we have our biggest earthquake months around here historically have been March, April, and October. So most likely it will be in one of those months. Well, can you pin it down better than that? I said, well, as we approach those months, I will certainly be watching to see what the animals do and the pigeons and the whales and the patterns of small earthquakes and homing pigeons, and everything we can get our handle on. The springs, the hot springs usually cool down and slow down their volume just before local quakes. And the geyser at Napa Valley slows down its eruption cycle. And so we get lots of clues. And I said, you know, wait, as we approach those dates. Well, as it turned out, my whole family, we went over to Hawaii in the second week April of 1984. And when I came back, I had a pile of Mercury News newspapers waiting there, and I started going through the lost and found columns, as I've been doing now since 1979, when a physicist from Xerox informed me that he looked at the lost and found column to predict local quakes because the numbers increased just before. And I almost hung up on him when he called me about that. And I realized that our cat Rocky had disappeared just before the 5.9 quake, the strongest since 1911, in 1979, disappeared on my birthday, July 31st, and the quake was on August 6th. Rocky was still gone a month later when the geophysicist called me, or he's a physicist, and so I began to pay more attention to what he was saying, and since that time, I have been daily recording the missing pets in the Mercury News, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Los Angeles Times, and it is a remarkable method in which to see how many frightened animals are out there, and give you an idea when there's just been the 4th of July or a big thunderstorm, or you're about to have an earthquake. So yeah, here we are in 1984, and as I was going back through the old newspapers while I was in Hawaii, I noticed that we suddenly increased from about 20 missing dogs to 41. And I put a circle around that and an exclamation point. I was going to look more at that. Then I also went to work, and that afternoon we had the 6.2 quake. So that was a successful prediction, even though publicly I had not predicted that it would be on April 24th. But isn't it odd that it was in the April, which is one of our big months, like 1906, and it was on exactly the same date in April, the 24th, as was the 6.5 quake that we had in 1890 following the record rainfall. We topped that record rainfall in 1983, and on April 24th of 84, we had the 6.5 magnitude quake, actually 6.2, which was quite damaging down in Morgan Hill. Nobody died, but it was certainly helpful to a lot of people, you know, complimented me on warning them about it, and they included that with the CSRS people in Evergreen Valley. They had actually prepared a seismic safety element, and they had used such data to get ready, and they were very pleased that I had warned them about it. So that wasn't the totality of the usefulness of predicting quakes, because when the World Series quake happened, of course, I'd been as vocal as I could about it. 2 years later, I retired after an additional 5 years. I was suspended as county geologist for 2.5 months for having had the audacity to predict a 6.5 to 7 magnitude quake within a week. And I called it the World Series quake in the newspaper. So, the reporter said, 6.5 to 7, that's going to scare a lot of people. And I said, well, let's top it off at a 6, because if people get ready for 6, they'll probably get ready for 7. I really don't want to frighten anybody. And so that's where it appeared, no higher than a 6. Well, my critics say, you didn't call it a 6.5 or 7, and it came in at 6.9 or 7.1. And I said, well, all the people that talked to me, it just happened that one article, because the reporter, I limited it to a 6. And besides, I had the day right. I mean, within a week. So it was right in the middle of my window. And I named it. I wouldn't name a 3.2 quake. It's stupid to make a name for that. But we have, like, the Thanksgiving Day quake, which I predicted, and the World Series quake, which I had also named. So several years later, I got a call from a former engineer with Lockheed, Tony Bell. And Tony said, Jim, I've been meaning to call you. He actually waited until he'd retired as an engineer with Lockheed. And he said, you know, you saved Lockheed several $100,000. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he said, well, I read your prediction, and I went to my boss, and I've been working on a rocket that was supposed to be shot off in about a month, and it was dismantled for final review in the green room. And a lot of pieces were on tables and scattered around, and we're certainly subject to a lot of bouncing if we had a big quake like you were suggesting. And so I went to my boss and said, shouldn't we kind of batten down the hatches, because of what Berkeley's saying? And his boss said, I already checked with the Geological Survey, and they said Berkeley doesn't know what he's talking about. So, but Tony Bell thought there might be something to it, and maybe it's just wise to be a little cautious. And so he did tie down all these loose parts, and they lost nothing. The shot went off on schedule, and that's why they saved several $100,000. And I said, well, that's sure good to know. I wish I'd heard about it while I was on suspension for 2.5 months and only allowed to return to work when I promised I wouldn't predict any more quakes on county time. But I sure appreciate you telling me that. And, you know, it does explain something that's often bothered me. Why had Lockheed officials called me and invited me and my wife to their annual picnic the following year? Now I know why. So they were sort of accepting that I'd helped them out a little bit. And so I guess the hot dog was worth several $100,000. So I've continued to do this since I retired. In 1985, I was asked to be on a television station in Seattle called Town Meeting, Como TV. Was on a Sunday, and they were going to fly me up to Seattle. And I said, well, I would like to, but I've been flying down to Los Angeles to be on the other side, another show down there on a Friday. But if you want me on the Sunday show, if you fly me directly from Los Angeles to Seattle, then I can make it. And they said, well, what we'll do is just call you at home. So I got home on Sunday, and the phone rang. And they said, now hang on, you'll be on in a few minutes. So I heard what was happening. They were having a town meeting about earthquake safety. And they had people from Red Cross and the University of Washington and the USGS and OES people and, you know, the whole gamut of earthquake safety people. And that was the discussion. And the moderator said, well, now we're going to have an earthquake prediction from a geologist in San Jose. Mr. Berkeley, are you there? And I said, yes, and I've been hearing what's happening on the line. And I want you all to know that I fully recognize that earthquake preparedness is a lot more important than earthquake prediction, because the quakes are going to happen whether you predict them or not, and you just have to deal with it. And he said, yes, yes, but we want your prediction. And I said, well, I just want to say also that if you think you're prepared and aren't, it's far worse than knowing you're not prepared, because you're going to count on certain things. Like, for example, when we had a massive power failure in late December of about 1980. I guess there was a power failure in the Northwest, and all along the Pacific Coast we had a blackout. And here I am at the county. We were trying to sign off building permits, and just before 5 o'clock it was already getting dark, and the power went off to the county building and all around the city. And so I said, don't worry, I've got my little light stick over here in my briefcase. So I went to get the light stick so we would have some light so we could sign off everything. And it turns out I'd already used that light stick as a demonstration a few days earlier at a public meeting. So we didn't have any light. There was no flashlight in the whole office. So these people that were so dependent on getting their building permit signed off by the end of the week were not able to do it. So we had to go down the stairs because the elevators weren't working, got into the car and drove home. Most of the traffic lights, well, they weren't working. There was no power. And so went across town, got up to my home in East San Jose, and saw it almost completely dark. There was a candle on the dining room table, and we had my guests from Canada there that just arrived, and everybody just talking around by candlelight. And I said, just a minute, I'm going to have the brightest house in town there on this side. I went down to get my Coleman lantern out in the garage. So it was all gassed up, and so I started pumping and pumping and trying to light it. It wouldn't light. It turns out it has a little generator that eventually wears out. This thing was 10 years old or more. And I didn't know that we had a generator that could fail. So we had to deal with candlelight. And the next day I went and bought another Coleman lantern and several mantles and an extra generator. And now I was really prepared. But this was a story that I gave to the people over the phone at the town meeting. And the moderator's getting a little antsy at this point. He said, yes, 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 but we want your prediction. So I was a little bit irritated at this point. I went beyond the data, and I said, well, based on the fact that you haven't had a five up there in several years, so you really do, but I'm going to predict that you're going to have a 3.5 in Seattle, 2.5 within a week. And this was on the 22nd of January. In 1995, and I instantly heard the tittering coming from this august group of experts sitting around at their town meeting, and I said, apparently your guests there are unaware of the hundreds of articles about tides and quakes and animals and quakes that are in the world press, and all of a sudden, he hung up on me. And that night I got about 3 calls from people up in the Northwest saying that wasn't very hospitable of them. We wanted to hear what you had to say. And then I got several letters saying the same thing. That was on the 22nd of January. On the 28th of January, a 5.1 magnitude quake hit Seattle Airport, SeaTac. And then within a few days, I got over 2,000 letters from the Northwest and 200 new subscribers to my newsletter. And so that was most gratifying. And one of those new subscribers was the head of the OES in Duval, Washington, a community about 20 miles north of Seattle. The following year, as a subscriber, he got my newsletter, Syzygy, an earthquake newsletter, in late April. And my seismic window was May 2nd to 9th. And I gave it, you know, this is a seismic window, and there's an 80% chance you're going to have a 3.5 to 5.5 quake in the Seattle area during that 8-day period. He received, as I say, that newsletter, and then on the 2nd of April, he started putting it to use because I talked about the importance of maintaining your preparedness. And he said in his phone call to me, I suddenly realized that we had 3 town generators, which I hadn't touched for about over a month since they were used during the flooding we had a couple of months ago. And so I went out and I greased them up and gassed them up and oiled them up. They're all ready to go that night, May 2nd, 1996. when the Duval quake hit. Now, that quake caused minor damage at the King Dome in Seattle, and they evacuated the people from the baseball game. And I got several letters from people, other subscribers. One gal said, well, she normally brought her baby when she went out at night. She brought it to a babysitter down in near the sound, the Puget Sound. And the babysitter lived in a big brick building. She said, I'm sure glad I didn't have to worry about how my little infant was doing. And another mother said that she hadn't let her kids go to the King Dome that night, and so that was one less worry that she had. So you see, there is utility to predicting earthquakes if you do it within reason. And right now I'm getting several calls and posts on my website from people that just say, oh, the world's going to come to an end. This always seems to develop after we've had a big quake, such as the 8.3 that we just had in the Kuril Islands. Now, that happened on the 15th of November. And my seismic window for November ended on the 10th. So I was essentially, my window was the 3rd through the 10th of November. On the 9th, we had a 4.0 near Willits, which met my Northern California prediction. And on the 3rd, the first day of the window, we had a 4.5 down by Salton Sea, which satisfied my Southern California prediction. So this, we hadn't had a major quake anywhere in the world since August. Meant we only had 9 so far. All 9 of them were in a seismic window. But this quake was not. The quake in the Kuril Islands, a great earthquake of 8.3, and the tsunami that came whistling down into Del Norte County again, and waves about 6 feet high, did a lot of damage to boats and destroyed 2 piers. And it was the first tsunami to hit that area since the Alaskan quake in 1964. But the tsunami and the earthquake, it took 10 hours for the waves to hit California after the quake in northern Japan in the Kuril Islands. Took that long to cross the Pacific. It was on day 10 following the last full moon. So that meant it wasn't in my standard seismic window, but lo and behold, the quakes in the Kuril Islands and Kamchatka just to the north, almost 80% of them occur between my normal seismic windows and the period I call a volcanic window. And this is an important factor because anyone that looks at all the quakes around the world, tries to see a correlation with the phases of the moon or whatever, they often don't see a correlation because they've lumped all of the areas together. And some areas have their own timing. And such areas are around volcanoes and Salton Sea, in strong east-west structures, such as the Mendocino Escarpment, going off from Cape Mendocino in Northern California, heading off for about 3,000 miles into the Pacific. So by recognizing individual areas where the quakes don't fit the pattern, you can segregate them from the universe you're studying and then see the correlation. So this was something that was recognized by seismologist Leon Knopoff from UCLA, now an emeritus professor there. In 1964, he had written a paper about how Southern California quakes had no relationship to tides from the sun and moon. And then in 1983, he had a revision. He said, by just restricting it to the San Andreas Fault in Southern California, I see a high correlation. And he co-authored a paper with the astronomer Steve Kilston. And the two of them wrote an article in July of 1983. And they said, based on our studies, we see a high correlation with the nodal point of the moon. It's an 18.2-year cycle. So every 9.1 or 2 years, you hit a nodal point. The whole cycle takes over 18 years. And the next nodal point following 1983 will be in November of 1987. So we believe there's a fairly strong probability of a 6-plus magnitude quake to hit the San Andreas Fault in Southern California around November of 1987, which was 4 years after their article was published. Well, lo and behold, the first 6-magnitude quake during that interval actually happened on November 22nd, 23rd of 1987, and that evening I was working late in the office, and it's interesting, they'd also said they found that most of the quakes occurred near dusk or near dawn. Well, it was near dusk on November 23rd of 1987, and I was working in the office, and my pendulum hanging from the ceiling is about a 5-foot-long line. I used a plumb bob. It began to sway about 1 inch, back and forth, back and forth. And as the people were walking by my office, I said, "Look at that! The last time that plumb bob swayed like that was back in 1978, when there was a 6.5 magnitude quake down by San Diego." And sure enough, San Diego had been shaken by this 6.3 quake that hit the Superstation Hills near Salton Sea, and it was near dusk. The next morning, a 6.7 hit in the same area near dawn. So they got 2 6-magnitude quakes, as predicted, 4 years after they made the prediction in the leading journal, Nature. So it's interesting to hear the reactions of the authors. Leon Knopoff told the reporter, "I've just spent the last 4 years trying to convince my colleagues I didn't actually try to predict a quake, and the damn thing happened." Now, Steve Kilston, the astronomer, was quite different. He was pleased as punch, and I heard him speak to the Astronomical Society in Santa Clara County, proudly talking about syzygies and perigees and perihelion, and how he and Leon had predicted those Southern California quakes at the time of the nodal point. And folks, this year is also a nodal point. 2006 is a nodal point of the moon. So watch, see what happens. But I sat down with Steve after his talk, and it was most interesting to sit in a chair and hear somebody up at the rostrum espouse the same things I've been talking about since 1974. And he also said, "The U.S. Geological Survey will no longer return my calls, his calls." And so apparently he's been right more often than they, and ego comes into the play. So here's another place where the earthquake was successfully predicted. The very first time that a very significant prediction was made was in China. And in 1975, in January, strange things were happening around Haicheng in China. There had been a pattern. It had been a very seismically active area, so the Chinese hadn't been too much worried about it, hadn't prepared much in that area, but they were trying to find out all they could about earthquakes. And so they found it pretty cheap to have Chinese peasants volunteer to look at animals, you know, the egg laying and the milk production and the insects in the field and snakes and pet animals and wild animals and whatever, and reporting in if they saw anything unusual. Meanwhile, the seismologists were putting some monitors around Haicheng because there was a pattern of small quakes. And then abruptly, the quakes stopped. At this point, because of the reports of animals in the zoos being very concerned and not eating as much or what their favorite food, prowling back and forth and not sleeping, they got radon gas was being released in some of the wells, and the wells begin to release gas like H2S that smells like rotten eggs, so it was easily detected by the peasants. And so they put all this together, and when the quake suddenly stopped, they said, folks, we were really, really here and concerned, and so everybody out of town. So they essentially evacuated the city of Haicheng of 100,000 people and had them with their blankets up on the hills listening to lectures on communism or whatever when the 7.3 quake essentially destroyed the city with not too much loss of life. It would have been devastating had they not evacuated Haicheng. Now, we can't do that in this country, and not even shouldn't. It's not going to happen like that here because we don't build like they do. But the quake happened on the last day of my first publicly announced seismic window. I had spoken to San Jose State University in 1975 in the mid-January and pointed out that my window from the 27th to the 4th of March, the 27th of February to the 4th of March, is that right? Excuse me, it was the 27th of January to the 4th of February. And the quake was on the 3rd of February, our time, and the 4th of February, the Chinese time, across the dateline. So it turns out that the Chinese had predicted a quake of 5.5 to 6. Now, when it came in at 7.3, that was about 50 times as strong as what they had predicted. So my critics would have to say they were wrong. And I say they may have been wrong in detail, but they did the important thing, and they saved lives. And they announced publicly their concerns. So it's unfortunate that the next year, this was a great advance for earthquake prediction, and suddenly people in this country began to pay attention, and they sent delegates over. I know one delegation from Stanford went over and reported that they complimenting them, and one Chinese seismologist said, oh, well, no, we don't pay attention to animals. We just use your standard battery of magnetic field changes and radon and so forth. He did not want to lose face to this delegation from the United States and denied that the animals had anything to do about it. But what happened the following year on July 28th is that an 8.1 quake devastated Tangshan, China. Now, this was a city of more than a million. And that quake was not predicted, although it should have been. And a lot of people say, well, they hit Haicheng, but what about Tangshan? What most people have forgotten is what was going on politically in China at that time, and the Gang of Four had taken over, and they had their cultural revolution telling everybody that science was bad, and we're going back to the past, and we're just going to go for the future. And they begin to destroy paintings and artifacts and take the scientists out of their laboratories and into the fields doing useful work like harvesting rice. They broke up this 100,000 peasant group that were reporting on animals. And so the Tangshan quake essentially took them by surprise. Shouldn't have. It was on the day of the new moon, the day of syzygy, July 28th, 1976. But people that say earthquakes can't be predicted say, well, look, the Chinese did. They predicted Haicheng. They got lucky, and they missed Tangshan. But at that point, it was because of the reactions of the Gang of Four. And instantly, China closed its borders. The UN said they lost about 655,000 people. China didn't say anything for a couple of years. Except they don't. We'll take care of everything ourselves. Don't anybody try fooling with our borders or anything. And then they finally said that, oh, it was a lot of exaggeration. It was only about 250,000 people that died. Only, well, the worst disaster in history was in China also in 1556 in Liaoning province, and they lost over 830,000 people, say at least. Because a lot of their buildings were very poorly made, and they had caves in the silt deposits, the lurch deposits, and a lot of those collapsed, and old families and hillsides came tumbling down. And imagine losing 830,000 people at least. Well, that stands as the all-time worst loss of life from any earthquake, but the Tang Shan quake would rank number two, unless you accept the phony 250,000, which would still be in the top 10, I think, for quake losses in terms of humanity. But and so the Chinese have kind of backed off quite a bit on their earthquake predictions, although I had a call last year from a Chinese seismologist who wanted to work with me. And he talked about a couple of predictions he had made on past earthquakes. And I said, well, that's well and good, but can you predict one for the next couple of months so that we can both watch and see what happens? You know, add a little credibility here. And he said he would like to, but the Chinese government will not allow the export of earthquake predictions. So I couldn't see how that would help anybody outside of China if they couldn't inform anybody. So I backed off on any cooperative study with him, but I'm certainly happy to make predictions and work with anyone that wants to tell me some method that they use. Now, I'm pretty much open-minded, and I don't have to have concrete statistics if I see that there's a pattern of success. I've always said you don't have to understand something to use it. If it works, use it. I don't know what's going on when I turn on the TV as long as it comes on. I don't know what's happening with my computer half the time. So if it works, use it. So I've become quite pragmatic, and I must say that one thing that I don't have much faith in is the astrology. I have many astrologers that have called me many times and say, hey, I could have predicted the World Series quake too, because Saturn was trine Mars or something, and I wish they would tell me in advance. Many, many astrologers have post-dicted earthquakes, not predicted them. And I would certainly pay attention if I knew firsthand some dates that they came up with and the quakes actually occurred. So I certainly believe in astronomy, and I have to believe that some people are psychic, because I've seen several people repeatedly predict quakes that were not scientists, that had no scientific knowledge, and just said they had a vision or had some evidence internally, a dream, and a date on a calendar. Okay, if it works, use it. And so I've had a couple of psychics contribute to my website. And unfortunately, they take a tremendous amount of criticism, as I have too. Somebody doesn't want earthquakes to be predicted, apparently. And so they tell people that, perhaps have headaches, before earthquakes, that they, they probably have a brain tumor and they better get an x-ray and talk to their doctor, or they're just psychological problems. I must admit that I had kind of that same concept when I got a call from New Brunswick, Canada. And this is why that happened in 1982. On January 9th, 1982, there was an eclipse of the moon. And, of course, I'd predicted a quake around here, the San Francisco Bay Area, for that period. And on that very day, in New Brunswick, Canada, they had the strongest quake to hit that province in 126 years, right near the Bay of Fundy. And a friend of mine, Stanton Friedman, had moved recently at that point with his wife back to New Brunswick, where his wife had been born. And she was, she still is, my wife's best friend. They both grew up in New Brunswick. And my wife had never felt an earthquake until that Thanksgiving Day quake hit in 1974 on November 28th. So, but here we are up to 1982, January 9th, day of the eclipse of the moon, and extremely high tides of over 50 feet in the Bay of Fundy. And that's the day of this first, the strongest quake of 5.9, which hit in the Miramichi River area in northern New Brunswick. And it happened on a Saturday morning, and on Monday I got a call from a radio station back there who had been informed by my friend Stan Friedman that perhaps I'd predicted their quake. So this lady interviewer said, did you predict our quake? And I said, I predicted the time for a quake in any seismically active area, but I didn't know what was going on locally back there. I didn't know what your animals were doing, your springs reheating or cooling down, or whether changes in water levels or radon gas or pattern of small earthquakes. There are a number of things that you might look for. She said, that sounds interesting. Do you mind if I roll a tape? I said, no, go right ahead. So she said, just a moment. Oh, my God. And then not another one. And so they had a 5.5 aftershock at the same time as she was on the phone with me. And I wondered, here we are 4,000 miles apart, and we're getting a 5.5 magnitude quake while we're on the phone together, and the epicenter's at the eastern end. Now, that's pretty unlikely. But anyway, she collected her wits and said, now, where was I? I said, you're about to roll a tape. Oh, yes, darn, I wish I'd been able to catch my own reaction. So anyway, she put up the tape there, and I did record about a 10-minute segment, which ran on their going-home show that night. 10 days later, I got a call from a lady from New Brunswick, Cuddyback, Sonia Cuddyback. And she said, Mr. Berkland, I hope you can tell what happened to me, or I fear I'm losing my mind. I heard you talking about animals, but 3 days before that quake, my head began to stuff up, and I got this worst headache of my life centered between my eyebrows. And it continued unabated for 3 days. On Thursday, before the Saturday quake, I couldn't even stay seated at luncheon with some teacher friends. I was constantly at sixes and sevens. And then on Friday night, I went to bed without supper. Woke up early the next day and tried to get up, but couldn't. I lay back on the bed with pain and pressure. Suddenly, as if passing a mountain peak, why, all the symptoms disappeared. And as I marveled at this first return to normalcy, the first tremors hit. So she said, I'm 46 years old, a school teacher, a native New Brunswicker, never felt an earthquake before, never had this kind of pain and pressure before from a headache. Do you have an explanation for it? And I said, well, maybe you are sensitive to earthquakes. I don't know quite why, but it might be useful to check with the University of New Brunswick and inform them about this sensitivity you have. Well, it turns out that she was extremely shy, wanted no kind of notoriety, and did not follow up. But 3 months later, I got a phone call from her. Excuse me for troubling you at work, Mr. Berkland, but yesterday it all came back, and this morning we had the 5.0, another aftershock, the strongest one in 3 months. I don't believe I can take this anymore. I think I'm going to put my home up for sale. Here she is, a native New Brunswicker. I said, hang on. You'll find that if you don't like earthquakes, New Brunswick, Canada is a good place to be. And you'll find that the frequency and the intensity of the aftershocks is going to decrease with time. Well, I don't know. And I said, besides, my wife and I are coming back there this summer, and I'd like to talk to you. And she was very evasive. And so we did go back in July. And I took my son and a friend to Gagetown, south of the capital of New Brunswick, which is Fredericton. And a little town of Gagetown, took a ferry boat across and the St. John River, stopped off at a grocery store and said, can you tell me where the Cuddybacks live? Oh, yeah, you pull off by that red barn and over the railroad station and over the railroad track and then out to the fields there and you'll see this little farm. So we drove out there and I found a fellow unloading the truck of his car beside his farmhouse. And I got out and I said, good afternoon. Have I found the Cuddyback residence? And this gentleman said, well, it was till 2 weeks ago. They moved to Virginia. So she did what she had threatened to do, left her normal place of security, and got out of the earthquake country that she no longer could live in. Now this is what animals do in advance of earthquakes. People do it when the ground is shaking. They run out of their homes and offices, often in blind fear. And animals have a little uncertainty and concern and disorientation prior to quakes. Not all of them, by any means. But some animals are sensitive, just like some people are. And so we have to recognize that and quit poo-pooing it. Now, maybe you don't have an animal or a dog or cat or chicken or parrot or whatever that is very disturbed prior to quakes. But maybe you do. And you should make a note of it and see if you can help on this whole problem. So that's what I tried to do in my former website, where I was getting a million hits every 2 weeks. And then somebody wanted me off, and I started getting hits with just vile posts and claims I was a liar and a phony and all this. And it looked like an innocuous little title, and you'd post on it, and you'd see the most vile pornography you could imagine, these terrible pictures. I finally couldn't take it anymore. I was losing sleep. So I abandoned my normal website, my Syzygy website that I'd been maintaining from 97 until 2005, and pulled in my horns and formed a much smaller group where I require people that want to post to send me $20 a year or to pay $40 a year and get my monthly newsletter, where I pretty much break even with my monthly newsletter. And if they pay, have some, you know, economic investment, then they can post. Anybody can read on my website, syzygyjob.com, but if you want to add something to it and post, it's going to cost you something. And that way, if you start posting something vile or, you know, totally full of cuss words, I'm just going to cut you off. And you have an economic risk there. So I haven't had any problem in a year. So I guess these were grammar school kids or something that were giving me the problem. But anyway, I can sleep nights, and I feel a lot more comfortable with my much smaller website where I only get a few hundred hits a day. Anyway, when we went back to New Brunswick, I stopped off at the university in July of after leaving the Cuddyvac residence, and I checked with the geologist there. And he came down from the geology building and by the seismograph they had down below, and I said, I'm Jim Berkland, a geologist from California, and I have an idea about the timing of earthquakes in general and yours in particular. And he said, well, it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon when the tides in the Bay of Fundy were over 50 feet high, and we think that extra stress triggered a weak place in the fault. And I think my jaw dropped, and I said, that's my idea. Would you please come to California and talk to some of my colleagues about this? Well, he kind of laughed, and it just makes sense. I did the arithmetic a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, and to see what are we talking about with the tidal weight, not just the gravitational stress, but the loading and unloading of ocean tides. Now, San Francisco Bay and Delta has over 500 square miles. How much does a foot of water weigh over a square mile? Turns out to be nearly 1 million tons, especially if it's cold, salty, turbid water. 500 square miles. For 1 foot, 500 million tons. And since the tides can range up to 9 feet, 9.2 feet max, multiply it out, see how many tons we're talking about. And this change occurs in just 6 hours. The tides come rushing in the Golden Gate, six, seven knots. The little boats can't even handle it. It goes clear up in the Delta, and then it sweeps out in 6 hours. And then it comes back in. Now, if you take a wire between your fingers and begin to wiggle it, wiggle it, wiggle it, you know what happens? It heats up with frictional resistance, and then there's metal fatigue, and the wire breaks. I've done it many times. Anybody can do it, especially with copper wire. It's always handy. Just wiggle, 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 pop. You can do it with a paperclip. So, same thing. You have, instead of metal fatigue, you have crustal fatigue. And old Mother Earth can occasionally slip a disc. And that's what an earthquake is. It's a slippage. And the only thing holding a fault together is friction. And how do you reduce friction? One way you reduce it is by having very slick rocks or having water. Water pore pressure. And that's the key to why landslides occur. Usually it's sudden influx of water. Builds up the water pore pressure, reduces the frictional resistance to movement. And if there's enough stress that develops, the movement will occur. And it certainly is obviated by water pressure. And so when I worked with the Bureau of Reclamation, one of my jobs was to watch observation wells before we built the California Aqueduct. We didn't want the ranchers to claim that we flooded them out or that we subtracted their water, so we drilled a series of wells and put a float on it, and then we had a little paper chart at the top, and it would record the change in the water levels, if any. Well, by golly, it went up and down twice a day, just a fraction of an inch. But it was quite clear that we had to tide in the groundwater in a water well. Most people don't notice it because you're pumping out of it, and then it's recovering and it's going up and down. But if the water is constant, you can measure this daily change in the elevation of a water well. Sometimes before a quake, a water well may rise or fall tens of feet. The Alaskan earthquake in 1964 caused about a 30-foot change in wells in Georgia and South Carolina. So it also causes, I was talking to a bellboy up in Reno, and he was in a boat in Lake Mead on the day of the earthquake in Alaska. I remember March 27th, 1964, the day of the full moon, the Good Friday. He said he was just about to step out of the boat onto the wharf in Lake Mead when suddenly the wharf was about a foot higher, and he almost fell into the water. They had a little stage wave, a little oscillation of Lake Mead from that quake that was over 2,000 miles north. Same thing happened at the biggest quake ever hit Europe in All Saints Day on November 1st of 1755. It hit Lisbon. That quake caused stage waves in Switzerland and up in Scandinavian lakes. So these large earthquakes cause huge results and effects at distances of over 1,000 miles, and not just tsunamis. Also, it's becoming more understood that a large earthquake can trigger other quakes at distances of hundreds of miles. It used to bother me when my colleagues would always tell the press that a quake in Southern California had nothing to do with a quake within a few days in Northern California, or vice versa. Quakes are random events. No, they're just... It's bound to get sometimes clustering in time, but it has nothing to do. And then in 1992, there was the Landers quake of about 7.3 down in the Mojave Desert. And within 3 or 4 hours, there was a 6.8 quake at Big Bear about 50 miles away. And almost just within a few minutes of the big Landers quake, there were a rash of quakes up at Mammoth Lake, and then another rash up around Lassen, small quakes, and over in Yellowstone. And then there was a 5.2 quake in Utah, and then another 5.5 quake down in Nevada near the nuclear depository site. And this was most disturbing to the experts have long said that there would be no 5-magnitude quake within 50 miles of the nuclear site, and they were proven wrong rather early on. So, as Yucca Mountain. So, at this point, it's finally become recognized that a large earthquake can trigger others, and not just aftershocks on the same fault nearby in the same relative time frame. So little by little, there's progress being made despite people saying that there's nothing to it. Early on, in 1975, I took an oral exam to be state geologist for the state of California. And I was on the third level of 17 people that had applied. And that was the year that the Oroville earthquake hit near Oroville Dam. And it occurred to me that the rapid filling of that reservoir caused a rapid change in loading. Water percolated down along an ancient fault line and probably produced the strongest quake, about a 5.9, around Chico and around Oroville. And there'd never been such one that we knew about so strong before in that area. Well, the pattern of epicenters led back underneath the dam. Pretty hard to ignore that. But the people with the California Division of Mines and Geology said, Jim, you know, we could work with you, but, you know, you better lay off this Oroville connection here because you know who built that dam. I said, yes, I know, state of California. They're a proud achievement, the largest dam I guess they built. And, you know, out of all those days of 49 gold mining tailings and massive earth-filled dam. And when that earthquake happened, it then caused a drastic change in the concern about the Auburn Dam. The Auburn Dam was also supposed to be earth-filled, and I worked on that dam. And we scouted around the area and realized that we couldn't get enough earth and rock without stripping off all the forests and the countryside. There just was no source nearby to make a dam 700 feet high. So that's when they went to concrete, the concrete design. Well, that's a whole different can of worms. The concrete dam was much narrower, much denser, and would put a tremendous load on the rocks by the dam site. And what were those rocks? Well, there was talc schist and weak amphibolite and serpentine. These are terrible rocks. And they were trying to overcome it with state-of-the-art investigations and special design and everything. But when the Oroville earthquake hit, a couple of old geologists, the former state geologist and another retired geologist, testified to the state assembly and said, we believe it would be a real mistake to build the Auburn Dam there because if you triggered a quake similar to what just happened at Oroville, that concrete dam would be full of cracks and you'd have no contingency plan about what to do. And so it could, if it failed, it would just overwhelm a Folsom Reservoir down below and probably bring a 50, 60 foot wall of water over Sacramento. So that caused a whole change in the Auburn Dam, and it has not been constructed, although there's still some effort to try it again. But I don't know how you could build it at that site, and I certainly wouldn't want to live below it. It was interesting that when they were trying to resurrect that whole plan, they had a meeting in San Francisco. And prior to this meeting, in the newspaper, they said an expert had said the rocks at the site were incredibly strong. Well, when I went to the meeting, I thought, well, that was just some PR guy. I didn't know what he was talking about. One of the geologists spoke to the group and said, the rocks at the dam site are incredibly strong. And so I raised my hand and said, you know, I've worked there, and I know it's serpentine and amphibolite and talc schist. And the only way you could call those rocks incredibly strong is with the derivation of the word incredible, which means unbelievable. And so I was admonished by someone, a lead geologist, who said, well, some of us are apparently unaware we have newsmen in the audience here. They like nothing better to have a dispute among the experts. Well, I think you should have a little honesty amongst the experts, too. And I was commended by a couple of people privately, but nobody supported me publicly at the meeting. So I've always been one to speak my mind. Once I got a responsible position, you know, I didn't rock boats much when I was a kid and when growing up. I was an honor student, and didn't drive a car until I was 18, and never took a drink of solid, you know, strong alcohol until I was 21. And pretty naive. And when I got even through junior college, I always thought that most facts had already been discovered, and that if you had some problem, some question, all you had to do was open the right book or go to the one right professor or some expert somewhere and get the answer. And when I got to Berkeley, I found, wow, there's a lot of controversial subjects out there, and that was very heartening to me to realize there's still many things to be discovered. And so when I came across this whole concept of predicting quakes, I realized that I had come to fruition. This is my life's purpose, and to demystify quakes and to deal with them as realistic natural phenomena and something that we can mostly prepare for. And we can, by increasing our understanding of what they do and what the limitations of earthquakes, they're not going to destroy the world, and they're limited in time and space. And the only earthquake of 83 now that I felt myself, the only earthquake that ever frightened me was the World Series quake. And even though I was expecting it, where was I when it happened? I was in the county building, and I was nobly working just past 5, because half the, three-quarters of the people on the 7th floor of the 13th-story county building had taken off to watch the World Series. And so at about 3 minutes after 5, I got up from my desk and headed out for the elevator, and then I saw the phone on the public counter in front. And I said, you know, maybe there's been a foreshock or some quake I should know about before I get home. So I started punching out the numbers for the Berkeley Seismographic Station, where they had a daily tape, and they would update information on California quakes. There were big ones around the world. So as I was punching out the numbers, I got to about one or two numbers left when suddenly the P wave hit from the 7.1. And for about 2 seconds, I was elated. I got my quake. I raised my fist in the air, and then suddenly I didn't want it, because there were crashing sounds all around me as file cabinets were dropping off. Books and rocks went out of my office. I couldn't see the floor when I went back to have a look. There were, you know, file cabinets knocked around in chairs. The whole building swayed back and forth for about 5 minutes. And during the quake itself, it was bouncing up and down and chattering and rotating and just moving about every possible direction. A giant microfilm reader machine slid across the counter, and I kept it from falling down and shattering, and held on the counter, and I was going back and forth. So after about 5 minutes, you couldn't take the elevator because they automatically shut off, and there were a number of people stuck in those elevators for a couple of hours, which was a bit of a panic. And I went down the steps and said, hey, they said, oh, that quake must have been down in Hollister. And I said, no, I think it was over here where we had the two foreshocks here last year, and then just a couple of months ago on August 8th, we had a 5.5 that some young fellow up in Redwood Estates, when it hit around 2 in the morning, he woke out of a deep sleep and just plummeted off the balcony and killed himself on the concrete driveway down below. So we had a death from that foreshock to the World Series quake or Loma Prieta quake. Now, here's another thing. Loma Prieta quake. Not only did we have all these animals missing and the Kilroy Hot Springs slowing down and cooling down as it had done before the 1906 quake and the 1952 Bakersfield quake and the 1979 Coyote Lake quake. We had the homing pigeon take off, and we had a deer coming down into one lady's patio. She'd never seen a whole herd of deer on her patio looking in at her at the kitchen on Sunday before the Tuesday quake. And so we had all of these clues, some 15 of them, which I've outlined in the book about me, written by Cal Ori, an author who has written half a dozen books. She's been mainly talking about animals and about nutrition, and she wrote about apple cider vinegar and the benefits of that. But anyway, for years she's been interested in earthquakes. And a couple of years ago she said she wanted to write a book about me, and I said, well, I've had three or four other authors all say they want to do the same thing, and once they start checking with high science, they say, oh, Berkeley's a nutcase. And so they've all backed off. But she followed through, and it's a very good book called Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, Jim Berkeley, Maverick Geologist. And it came out in January, and you can get it on Amazon for about $12. You can get it at a bookstore. It's $16.95. It's almost 300 pages, and, it's a very good book. And it talks all about how animals predict and what experts think about me and what I think about them. And examples of the 23 quakes of at least 5 magnitude that were main shocks in the Bay Area that have occurred since 1974, and how I predict all of them within one day of my window. So, and it showed what the animals were doing at various times. Anybody like proof of it? I've got all of those in my catalog. Daily changes and the total of missing pets. So, there are many clues to quakes. And if we turn our backs on the evidence, then we can say, I don't see any evidence. And that's what many colleagues have been saying over the last few years since they gave up on predicting quakes. The main reason they gave up is because they put all of their eggs in the Parkfield basket. And in 1985, they said, we think there's going to be a 6 magnitude quake about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco near Parkfield on the San Andreas Fault, because there's been a pattern since 1857 of such a quake occurring about every 22 years. 1857, 1881, 1901, 1922, 1934, and 1966. Well, the 66 quakes of a couple of 5.5 hit while I was down in Coalinga working on the California Aqueduct. And I went dashing out of the motel where I was typing a letter to my wife-to-be, compared notes to everybody. Boy, that was a pretty good jolt. And across the street was this big water tower that was swaying back and forth. And so we all talked about it and went back inside our rooms. And 20 minutes later, a second quake hit from about 25 miles away down at Parkfield. And that fault ruptured the ground, cut across the highway. And it was, pretty interesting. But there hadn't been another one at Parkfield. And about 22 years after that, 66 would have been 1988. So high science, USGS and local universities and colleges all said, we really think there's going to be a 6 magnitude quake in that area within 4 years of 1988. And we would give it a 95% chance of occurring, and we're going to capture it. This is going to be the first successful earthquake prediction that we've achieved. And they instrumented it. They had a small army of people getting ready for the quake, writing papers about it, leading foreign dignitaries along the grounds and seeing all the various instruments they had there in the drill holes and their studies of various aspects of what happens in the ground before earthquakes. Well, the quake did not occur. And by 1993, they admitted failure. And that's the 12th myth that I know about. And then they stopped talking about earthquake predictions and focused on earthquake preparedness, which is fine. It was fine that they were looking at earthquake preparedness and the proper design of buildings and all that, but it's really dumb not to continue their studies on earthquake prediction because it's happening. It's happening all around them, and they're just ignoring it. So it turns out that it was such a severe shock to miss that quake that they lost one-third of their geologists or about one-quarter of them at Menlo Park, and they almost lost their Menlo Park headquarters. It would have been terrible. They were going to break up the USGS. Send the oceanographers up to Seattle and the surveyors over to Sacramento, and indeed a number of their top staff moved around, worked to the various colleges or retired. The most unfortunate. So, anyway, that quake finally happened. Parkfield finally happened in 2004. And what was its date? September 28th. Well, it happened to be on the day of the full moon. I don't see high science discussing that, however. But it's really strange. In that same year, I've been telling people all year long to look out for the time around Christmas of 2004 because there was a 9.2-foot tide, which is at the Golden Gate, which cannot be exceeded. That's the highest possible. It happens about once every 10 years. Very rare to see such a high tide. And I knew it was coming up on the 23rd of December. So my window was the 21st to the 28th of December in 2004. And my newsletter talked about it. And during the year, I mentioned it several times. Well, on the 22nd of December, the day after my window opened, we got the Paso Robles earthquake where the two women were killed in their little shop there. And it was also called the San Simeon quake. Felt all over Central California. And it was a 6 magnitude quake and 6.5. And it caused the hot springs to develop in Paso Robles and sulfurous gas come out and hot water. And it was a pretty impressive event. And it was right in that window with the maximum possible tides. Then we had Christmas. And the next day, the 26th, there was this huge quake in Bam, Iran, where over 20,000 people died. And the window was wide open. And that was also a 6.5 quake. And again, clearly shows the difference. 25,000 people died versus 2 from 6.5 magnitude quakes and comparing U.S. and Iran. So, this new and full moon thing works time after time. The Bakersfield quake or Tehachapi quake in 1952 was a 7.7, and it occurred on July 22nd, 1952, just south of Bakersfield. And it was on the White Wolf Fault, the Tehachapi Mountains. And it was on the day of the new moon. The strongest aftershock was a 6 magnitude that occurred in July, I think it was the 23rd, on the day of an eclipse of the moon, of the sun, day of the eclipse of the sun. So the quake in San Fernando in 1971 was on February 9th, and it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon. It was a 6.6, and I was surprised to see in 1980, I went back to see what the record showed in the LA Times. What were the animals doing prior to this? Sure enough, the number of missing dogs and cats had just leaped up a few days before that San Fernando earthquake. And then as I went through the newspapers for the few days afterwards, I noticed the very next day in the LA Times, in the middle of the paper, here was an article where they were interviewing the director of the Griffith Park Observatory. And what was his name? But anyway, he said, "I think yesterday's earthquake had something to do with yesterday's eclipse of the moon. Not that it caused the quake, but through extra gravitational stress, triggered a weak place in the fault." Now, he had the idea 3 years before I did, because he was 1971. I didn't get that same idea until early 1974. But astronomers find this concept to be pretty acceptable. They see what's happening. On the moon, there are moon quakes. They mostly occur every 27 days when the time of perigee, when the Earth is closest to the moon and the Earth's gravity is most effective on the Earth, on the moon. So it causes the moon to rise and fall and helps to trigger quakes. There's also a secondary little flurry 2 weeks later at the time of apogee at the far point. So it shows it's not just the pure total physical force, but it's the rate of change of that force. So that's another aspect that I'm not ignoring when I look at the seismic windows, because only one syzygy can have a perigee, you know, the closest approach each month. Because there's only one perigee every 27 and a half days, one every syzygy every 29 and a half days. And as I mentioned earlier, to get a syzygy and a perigee on the same day, only from 2 times a year to up to 5 times per year. So those are always very clear seismic windows. And time after time, we get those under such conditions. But sometimes you get a very strong quake away from perigee. Well, so the whole topic of earthquake prediction is live. This is not a dead issue. And it's really ridiculous for the experts to say they can't be predicted. You know, before I got into this thing, I believed it. All of my professors and all the books, they kind of laughed at earthquake prediction. And then, especially after the Chinese success in 1975, there was this new interest. Now, I must say, after I predicted the 5.9 quake of August 6th, 1979, that was the strongest quake since 1911 until 1984 when we had the 6.2 until 1989 when we had the 7.1. But that 1979 quake at Coyote Lake was a real eye-opener. Now, I have been calling for such a quake to occur between the 7th and 14th of August, and it happened on the morning of the 6th. And so all these experts say, well, you missed it. It didn't happen until the next day. And I said, but there were a number of aftershocks, a 3.5 to 5.5 magnitude quake that did occur in the window. Well, you can't count aftershocks. Why not? They're earthquakes. You can count foreshocks, as long as they meet the other criteria. Time after time, when a quake happens, and then maybe a day early or so, they say, well, you missed that. And I say, well, the aftershocks are in the window. Oh, you can't count those. Who scores this? Who's the expert on scoring earthquake predictions? Heck, I'm as good an expert as anyone on scoring earthquakes, and so I'm using my dartboard method, and I'd encourage anybody else to use it. So I was asked to address the State Committee, Earthquake Prediction Evaluation Council, and they called me after the 79 quake, and had me come up and meet them at Stanford. And they very carefully said, now, this is not an official evaluation of your prediction method. We just want to hear what you have to say. So here I came to this meeting of about 20 experts sitting around a big table. And I brought my data in, and I stood before them and talked about how I had predicted that quake, even though it was 14 hours early. Yeah, but it caused me to adjust my windows now to mostly open them the day before syzygy instead of waiting till the moment of syzygy, which I'd been doing for the first 5 years of my effort. So here are all these experts, including the state geologist, and he said, Jim, you know, I go down to Imperial Valley every year for 3 days to do chukar partridge hunting. And about half the time I'm down there during those 3 days, we feel an earthquake. So I think you ought to look at 3-day windows. And I said, Jim, if you really believe in that, why don't you assemble your data and present it here to the same body like I'm doing, he went home and kind of backed off. And then I brought out of my pocket a whole list of earthquake experts since 1966. They've been publishing data saying we have, we think that now we might be able to predict earthquakes, and we think that within 10 years we'll have it in hand. That began in the 1960s. Then about 5 years later, another expert said, I think we're about a decade away from effective earthquake prediction. Then a few years later, another expert, I had about 8 of these citations of prominent experts all saying we're about 10 years away or a decade away, and it was always a moving target. And then about a week before, they'd asked me to appear before the Earthquake Prediction Evaluation Council. There was an article in the paper from regarding a Russian scientist who said, I believe we are about 5 days away from very useful earthquake prediction. I quoted that paper. I leaned forward on the table and spread my fingers and said, gentlemen, we have an earthquake prediction gap. Nobody smiled. Nobody chuckled, which is I anticipated, because this is what we'd always heard about a missile gap and all. And earthquake prediction gap, not 10 years as we'd been saying, but only 5 years according to the Russians. Well, the Russians are still working on it too. And we had a Russian scientist call for a 6.4 in the Mojave Desert here 2 years ago. Dr. Kelis Borak. And he's from UCLA. And he had predicted the San Simeon quake, he said. And he had predicted an earlier quake in Hokkaido of 8.1. Well, I predicted both of those, too, in my newsletter. All of my readers know I did. We did not see his predictions before the quakes happened. But then he said it's going to happen at 6.4 by September 4th. And his quake did not happen. And I attended a meeting in Oakland where they were discussing his prediction. And it had been widely published in the newspapers in January and then again in March as if we're new, and then again in July when this meeting was being held. So I attended this meeting of about 100 scientists and engineers and sat up near the front, heard everybody talk about, well, we don't know if it's going to happen, but you think he has a right to predict it and everything. So I got up and I said, well, I think this is very good that he's keeping the whole topic of earthquake prediction open. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I must say that the two quakes he says he predicted earlier, I also predicted, and I have copies of my newsletter right here showing how I predicted those, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody following the meeting. Not one person came up to ask for my evidence. And when I held it out to a few people, they shied away like I was offering them hemlock. And I realized that we have not made that much progress in opening up our minds to ideas, but we are still closed-minded on many things. And that is not what science should be. I never will close my mind, but I'm going to keep it open along with my eyes and ears and continue to work on earthquake predictions. I'm at 76 years of age. I expect to be around for another 10 years. And I'm going to be a thorn in the side of any scientist that says earthquakes cannot be predicted. So we'll let it go with that, folks, and be happy to hear from you. Visit my website at syzygyjob.com. Syzygyjob, J-O-B are my initials. Send me a letter if you would like to get a copy of my newsletter. Just P.O. Box 1926, Glen Ellyn, California. The zip code is 95442. Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and if you put in a couple dollars in there, it'd help me defray my expenses, because I'm pretty much, this is a labor of love, and an obligation that I feel that I must do. And so I'd be happy to hear from any of you and hear what your ideas might be. Good night. High, high.